become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Welcome to the Movie Geeks United 40th Anniversary Tribute to the film Scarecrow. This under-the-radar gem from 1973 is based on a screenplay by acclaimed writer Gary Michael White, a script, incidentally, that Al Pacino called the best he'd ever read, and it's directed by Jerry Schatzberg, a high-profile photographer who moved into filmmaking only a few years prior. Scarecrow features the first and only pairing of two acting titans, Al Pacino and Gene Hackman.
Behold, the captains of industry, the prospective owners of Maxie's Car Wash, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
You mean Maxie's Car Wash?
Car Wash?
Yeah. Okay. For every car, there is dirt.
Max and Lion. The only difference between them and the Rockefellers is a few hundred million dollars and about 1,500 miles. First off, there's Max.
I've got to tell you something about me. I'm about the meanest son alive, you know what I mean?
Huh?
I don't trust anybody. I don't love anybody. Hey, we're going to be partners, okay?
Okay.
All right, come on.
Max did 6 years in prison for beating the hell out of a guy, and it didn't teach him a thing.
Okay. All right.
No, Max.
Just one way. Max. One way. Get out.
Believe it or not, Max is the brains of the partnership.
Oh, all of me. Plastic pipe for durability. $600.
And then there's Lion.
I think your specialty is going to be waxing.
Waxing?
No. No, and keeping the customers happy.
Lion figures if you can make somebody laugh, you won't ever need to fight.
Why did you call stupid girl? Get out of here.
Hey, Max! Hey, Max!
Lion is a scarecrow.
That's right. Who's laughing? No, you don't have to hit people. Not if you make them laugh.
No, crows are not scared, believe me.
The crows are scared.
No.
And the,
crows are laughing.
Crows are laughing, right. You know, in the joint I heard some tales, man. Oh, boy, howdy, I heard some tall tales. I mean, you're not playing with the full deck, man.
It's been 5 years. You know, your wife might be married. She might have moved away. Why don't you give her a call?
Look, I want to see my kid, right? What am I going to do, shove the lamp through the phone?
Sure. Send the money and see the world.
Annie, please. Look, let me come over.
I don't want to see you.
Max and Lion, the prospective owners of Maxie's Car Wash. All they have to do is get to Pittsburgh. But between California and Pennsylvania, there are a lot of ups.
Keeps on the house for everybody!
And a lot of downs. Max and Lion, the future owners of Maxie's Car Wash, Pittsburgh, PA.
We celebrate this moving and insightful film with its screenwriter Gary Michael White and director Jerry Schatzberg. First up, Gary Michael White, who penned the screenplay to Scarecrow soon after breaking into the film and television industry. Mr. White eventually returned to his first passion, playwriting. It is in that field that he continues to craft vital works, including his latest play titled The Girl Who Was the Sun, which will begin its search for a proper home later this year. You can read more about Gary and his phenomenal body of work at GaryMichaelWhitePlays.com.
I did not have a desire to be a screenwriter. That was not part of the plan. From the time I was about 13, I wanted to be in the theater. And I went to drama classes in high school and junior high and and then majored in drama at San Francisco State University, and then went on to the Goodman Institute in Chicago. It was all toward being a director, really. And then I found that directing didn't have enough control for me. And so I began to explore writing and began to produce my own plays in college and found that it was a really good fit. When I was at the Goodman Institute, I was faced with a big decision. They wanted me to direct there. I was on a full scholarship, and I had to choose not to write. They wouldn't let me write. I had to direct only. And it was at that time, 1963, when the assassination of JFK took place. And I found that I could not stay in higher education at that time. I had to get out and start to write about things. And so I left there, and I went to Mexico, and I wrote my first full-length play in Mexico. And then by the time I came back to California, I was very much a committed writer, and ended up getting married, and I was about to have my beautiful son, Peter, and I went to the playwrights unit at UCLA and got a job, classic job, parking cars in Hollywood. And while at UCLA, I wrote a play that won an award in the Samuel Goldwyn competition. And as a result of that, it was written up in Variety and Hollywood Reporter and all of that, and suddenly I had agents approaching me. And I didn't even have a telephone. And one agent came out and left a note under my door in Venice, California. And he was such a persistent, wonderful guy. His name was Lee Rosenberg, that I signed on with him. And he got me involved with film directors. And so then I was sort of through the back door into screenwriting. But playwriting has always remained my big love. And I'm back at it again now.
When I think about playwriting, I mean, it feels like such a romantic notion, like a very pure form of writing. And I'm curious, is that what drew you to that form of writing in particular, the purity of it?
You know, the moment I knew I wanted to be in the theater was when I was in a Christmas pageant in junior high school. And I was backstage, and I looked out, and I saw the audience, and I said, this is such a ritual. This audience, dressed in funny clothes, are all sitting down in these uncomfortable seats to experience something that's not real. And it's like being in church. And I thought, if I could be part of that, that would really be a wonderful vocation. I didn't use those words, but that's the feeling I had. And that's always the feeling I've had. There's something about the theater. Film can get there. It truly can get there. When you see, I think, Citizen Kane or 2001, A Space Odyssey, you are drawn into a ritual. But theater is designed to be that, and it's designed to be a one-on-one with the audience. I mean, you can walk right down as Hamlet does and talk straight to them if you want to, if the playwright wants you to. And your themes are expressed by human behavior, not by plot points. I think David Mamet described the difference between the two as being film feeding you information as opposed to playwriting feeding you behavior. That's probably a bad paraphrase, but that was generally what he was saying. And I think that's true. Film is an exciting medium, but for me, the beginning of it was playwriting, because I was so interested in touching the audience directly.
Yeah.
And amazingly enough, I never wanted to be a film director, because that seems so far removed from the audience. I know it isn't. And I know when Scorsese looks through a lens, he's looking exactly the way he wants the audience to see it. But it always felt removed from me as a writer. I never got as comfortable with screenwriting as I am with playwriting.
Mm. So when Scarecrow came to you, was it an idea that you had specifically for the screen, or had it been percolating before that?
Well, you know, when I was still finding myself, I did a lot of hitchhiking. And I hitchhiked from California to Pennsylvania to do a summer stock period. And while I was on the road, I met the guy who became my prototype for Max. We were at a crossroads, and he stood in front of me without seeing that I had been there first. And he had a cardboard suitcase, and he was obviously just a really down guy. But I wasn't going to just lose my place in line, so I hemmed, you know, and pointed out to him that I got there first. And he said, "Well, do you have to go east?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to Pennsylvania." And he said, "Cool, that's fine." And he walked across the road and headed north and put out his thumb. And I was at that time taking notes because I was writing plays. And I jotted him down as a really wonderful character to keep my eye on. And later, after I had done my first assignment as a screenwriter, after I had been signed on to my agency, and I was now starting to think in terms of film because it was being kind of insisted upon me by my agency, you know, think film, that character reemerged. And I started to devise a story around that beginning, literally around that encounter, which made it pretty much intact into the final film, as you know. And then it was just a question of finding the other character, and that was pretty easily done as well.
So was it a question of when you're thinking of a character to pair up with Max, finding someone obviously with some opposite attributes? I mean, Max is a very abrasive person, but Lion, on the other hand, is very soft-hearted and almost vulnerable in a way.
Absolutely. Well, Lion is hiding a big secret. He's running away from himself. And Max is running toward the new self that he wants to be. And the theme of Scarecrow really is about a very, very hard man who becomes softened through friendship, but stronger in a different way, so that when his new friend falls, he is able to pick him up and help him. And it's really that essence. So what I wanted in Lion is I wanted a character who expressed a gentle approach to life, but was not a weak character, was not, you know, somebody who wasn't going to be interesting to the audience. And I have been, during my college years, working with a wonderful comic named Al Cingolani, and we had worked a lot together, both in college and then in a cabaret. And he had a very, very physical sense of humor and very funny guy. And I spoke to him and I talked to him about this, and I developed Lion along the lines of, one, my thematic needs, which was his approach to making crows laugh rather than scaring them, and Al's particular shtick, which was very visual, and it was very hard to write it. But we did. As a matter of fact, Al got a part in the movie and went on to get an agent. But he obviously couldn't play the lead because that was going to be Al Pacino.
Mm-hmm.
So the two characters were then in place. And then it was a question of finding the mutual dream and, of course, the terrible secret that Lion was running away from. And for that, I delved back into my own childhood, which was being raised in the Roman Catholic Church, and found the demon that would be lurking in him there.
Mm. Another strength of the piece for me is its portrait of America at that time. Max is someone that might be somewhat embittered by his experiences, but Pacino is still kind of wide-eyed and hopeful. And I think those two points of view are two points of view that you can use to look at America in that period of time as well. Am I reading
too
much?
Well, certainly you're going to look at America when you have two people hitchhiking on the road. I wasn't out to do what Kerouac did. This was an interior journey. Mm-hmm. And Max has been a three-time loser. He has come out of prison knowing he cannot go back. He must change his ways. He must listen to his sister, who's been for years banging on his head, saying, Max, give it up. We're not kids fighting for our lives anymore. You don't have to do that. And Lion panicked and walked away from a wife and an unborn child, which is a very hard, hard thing to do. He just ran scared. And he is now, yes, he's wide-eyed, but he's wide-eyed in the way that people are wide-eyed when they're afraid of the dark. And I think that that's an important, and certainly Al Pacino understood that and played that very subtly and very well. Mm. That his fear, which finally comes and grabs him by the throat, is always there motivating him. He is not just a sprite from Midsummer Night's Dream. He is a frightened young man who is going to go back and face his biggest fear, which is exactly what Max is doing. And that's why they need each other, because they're both limping toward Bethlehem, kind of. They've got to find their strength, and they find it with each other. And it's such a perfect find that when Max has to, he turns over his hard-earned savings to try to save his friend.
Yeah.
And I've always been, by the way, amazed when I see blurbs of Scarecrow calling them two, you know, charming losers. Because it seems to me that they are far from losers when they achieve what they achieve interior to themselves, when their spirits transcend the fear that they have lived with for so long through each other. I would not call that a losing experience at all. I never have. I don't now.
Tell me how the theme of the Scarecrow started to play into that. How did that manifest itself?
You know, I can't answer that question. It was in the writing. I can remember where I was, and I can remember how hot a summer day it was. And I had them getting ready to go to bed, and Lion was jabbering away, and it just somehow came to me that he would have this idea about standing out in a field and being a clown and making the crows laugh, and therefore, important point, the crows would spare the field, not because they were afraid of him, but because he made them laugh, and they went on and bothered somebody else.
Hey, Max, you know the story of the Scarecrow?
Yeah.
Do you think crows are scared of a Scarecrow?
Yeah, I'm scared.
Yeah, why? No, crows are not scared, believe me.
The goddamn crows are scared.
No. Crows are laughing.
That's bullshit.
That's right, crows are laughing. Look, the farmer puts out a scarecrow, right, with a funny hat on it, it's got a funny face. Crows fly by, they see that, strikes them funny, makes them laugh.
The goddamn crows are laughing.
That's right, they're laughing at Rasmussen. And then they say, well, that old Farmer Jones down there, he's a pretty good guy. He made us laugh, so we won't bother him anymore.
The goddamn crows are laughing.
Oh, they laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Woo!
I gotta tell you something. That's the most harebrained idea I ever heard.
Well, it's true. Laughing your asses off.
That summed up for me his defense mechanism, his whole raison d'etre about getting from point A to point B without getting hurt. And that he would pass that on to Max, who immediately says, that's the craziest idea I've ever heard. But later on says, that's a pretty damn good idea. And I'm going to try to live by it. And he actually does live by it when he does his striptease. So the answer is, it was in a moment of writing, and I didn't prepare for it. The characters were starting to speak by that time, which is wonderful when that finally takes place.
when you finished the screenplay, what was it? United Artists were the first studios to have an interest in it, correct?
Yes, they bought it.
Okay. Did they have any demands from it or changes, or did they purchase it as it was?
They purchased it as it was and then decided immediately not to make it, which is, you know, classic Hollywood.
Yes.
They put it, I guess, what's called turnaround, and or turnabout, I forget. Yeah, turnaround. And it languished for a year or a year and a half, and I went on to other things. And then through what process, I'm not sure. It may have been an actor friend of mine named Anthony Zerbe. It may have been Lee Rosenberg. I'm not sure. Somebody got it to Al Pacino, and he was just flat out immediately enamored of the script and of that character. And he said, I want to do this. And he had just had The Godfather released, so he had the ability to make things happen. And based on that, Warner Brothers bought the script from United Artists, and they went forward with it.
I idolize Al Pacino. He's kind of my creative idol. He has been since I was a kid, and I was born the year Scarecrow came out. And I look at his performance in Scarecrow, which is remarkable. And then the very next year, he played kind of the opposite of that with Godfather II, with the blackened eyes. Did you spend time with Pacino? Did you discuss the role and the script with him?
I did. It was a very strange situation. He was obviously a very hot star now, and he was being protected by everybody. But he wanted to talk with me, and so I met with him a few times, once over lunch and then once in his hotel room. And then, you'll love this story, I think. He and Gene Hackman decided they had to experience some reality to this. So they actually got on the road together, dressed up as Max and Lyon, and hitchhiked from Bakersfield to San Francisco. And they, you know, they were, well, who's going to be recognized? And they both were recognized at different times. Hackman was very famous for The French Connection at the same time that Pacino was very famous for The Godfather. But anyway, at one point, I was at home and I was having a poker party. And I'm playing poker and the phone rings. And I answer the phone and, hello. He goes, Gary, it's Al. Al Pacino. Yeah. Where are you? Well, we're in San Francisco. And Gene's taking a nap. You know how Max, he has to take a nap. So Gene's taking a nap. And I have this idea, and he had this idea about Lyon. And he was very enthusiastic about it, and I said, well, you know, that's a fairly good idea, but I don't think it works because it plugs Lyon into the present too much. He wanted to carry a radio next to his ear, and he was listening to the radio all the time. I said, the thing about Lyon is that he comes from a time bubble. He's not connected to anything. And that's why it's able to come up and ambush him the way it does. And he went, God, that's right. That is so right. Forget I asked. So we hung up the phone, and I went back to the table, and my friend says, who the hell was that? And I said, oh, it was just Al Pacino. I raise you $5.
Well, that's beautiful. And that also shows, I mean, this is the Pacino we know today as well. Obviously someone that came from the theater and who has remained with the theater, who
absolutely,
whose big kick out of what he does is the journey, is the discovery, is the nonstop investigation, I think.
Yeah, he is a brilliant, brilliant actor. He's wonderful on the stage. Recently, he was directed by a man who was a friend of mine in college, Dan Sullivan.
We both
went to San Francisco University together in the same class. And he directed him in Merchants of Venice. And Al has never not worked in the theater. He worked in the theater before his film career. He worked in the theater sporadically during his film career. And he is still working in the theater. And it is I have such admiration for him. It is really hard to express in a few words.
Well, when Scarecrow was picked up by Warner Brothers and Al Pacino kind of saved it from being in turnaround, eventually Jerry Schatzberg came on as director. And I would imagine there's always kind of give and take between writer-director because it's all a question of interpretation once a director comes on board. How did the two of you meld in that process?
Well, fine. You have to understand that before Jerry came on board, there was another director. And he was assigned first by Warner Brothers. And he brought me into his office and said, what we need is a rewrite. And what we want is a rewrite with a whole different ending, which is going to be blah, 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 blah. And it was, in my view, horrific ending. But I had sold the script, so I had zero input into what they were going to do about it. And so it was decided to take it out of my hands and turn it over to other hands, and I was sent back home. This director then flew to Boston, where Al Pacino was doing Richard III, and he presented him with the fait accompli that he was going to have the script rewritten, and Pacino didn't say anything to him, but when he arrived back in L.A., he had been removed from the project at Al Pacino's insistence. Al then brought in Jerry Schatzberg, who directed him in Panic in Needle Park, and they had a great relationship. And so Jerry was already tuned in to the fact that Al was committed to this script. So that whatever possible conflicts Jerry and I may have had was eschewed by that reality. I didn't have any conflicts with Jerry Schatzberg. And then, once again, you have to remember, I didn't have much to do with the production. Mm-hmm. Writers are not generally welcome on a set, but even if they were, I wouldn't have wanted to be there. It's not my gig. I was on to other things, and I did want to see dailies, and I did see some dailies and all of that. But Jerry Schatzberg was always an extremely efficient and creative guy. He was dealing with the two hottest stars in the business. You can imagine how hard that must be. And he did it, and he got the picture, you know, brought in on time and on budget, and you know, hats off to him.
Did the casting of Hackman make sense to you? Because I mean, obviously Pacino and Hackman separately are the two greatest actors that cinema's ever known. But together, I mean, this is a combustible combo. But was Hackman a great choice, did you think, from the beginning?
Oh, I think I fell on the floor when they told me he was assigned for an act. Honest to God, I thought. I mean, I saw him in the Poseidon Adventure, and I said, "This is a huge star about to happen." I knew it long before, or not long before, but certainly before French Connection, and I just knew when they said he was going to be Max that my troubles were over. That I was going to have my tough Max with a heart that could be found.
Yeah, yeah. So when you finally see the finished film, I would imagine you attended a premiere. Was that the first time you saw it in total?
Yes, it was not a premiere. It was an industry screening.
Okay.
For agents and directors and, you know, this at one of the studios at Warner Brothers. And this is a story. I guess this is an anecdote that goes to the heart of what would not happen in a play, for instance. The Warner Brothers had a film with two of the hottest stars, and they wanted to make sure that they could screen it maximum times daily to take advantage of that fact. And therefore, the film was cut to make it a little shorter. And part of the material that ended on that famous cutting room floor was the very material that I had so carefully constructed into the script to show the gradual break in Lion, where he goes from wide-eyed innocent to wide-eyed scared and finally to catatonic. And when they edited out those steps in his deterioration, it became for a lot of people that I've talked to, a lot of people, a puzzling collapse in his character. And I think it harmed the movie, and I think it harmed Warner Brothers' desire to capitalize on the commercial nature of the starring that they had. And I'm sorry that that happened, and it's just about my only complaint about the film. And recently, two actors named Shiloh Fernandez and Noah Segan have done a play adaptation of Scarecrow.
Really?
And they worked with me very closely as they did that, and we reincorporated all those elements of Lyon's collapse into the play. So if and when that gets produced, that problem will not be on stage.
I would be intensely interested in seeing that. But as it is now in the film, it's the phone call, which is incredibly intense and heartbreaking between he and the mother of his child, and then it cuts right to the fountain scene where he kind of collapses and becomes a catatonic. Isn't that how it plays now? So everything in between.
Oh yes,
there
the collapse of Lyon was built into all the areas prior to that phone call. That phone call, which is, I agree, perfectly rendered, is the culmination of a lot of minor steps which have been weakening his legs, so that when he comes out of that booth, his legs go out from under him.
But you leave. Yeah, I got it. I told you I got it. Thanks for a big fat nothing. You just left. Happy? Sure. Sure, I'm happy. I'm Mrs. Joey Banana King, and I look like an old lady. You left. You just... Oh, you stinking shit. You coward. Sure. Send the money and see the world. Leave Annie here. Leave me here in this goddamn stinking slum, you bastard, you...
Please, Annie. Annie, please, look, let me come over.
I don't want to see you. You just get away. You just stay away and get out. Oh, God. Francis? You didn't ask about the kid, Francis.
I was going to. So what is it? Boy or girl?
Dead. Dead. Never even got born, Francis, because I was... left alone. Do you hear me, Francis?
That phone call now is being asked to carry the entire weight of Lyon's collapse, and it should be asked to do that. So I just went about my business and said, "Let's hope for the best." It's a wonderful film. I had no idea it was going to be 4 years later being honored with a special screening in New York and with this interview from you, which is just delightful, but I knew that it was a special piece of work, and I knew that the actors were flawless and wonderful.
Well, it does feel for many people. When I started to get into Pacino in grade school, I would review all of his films, and that's when I found it. So I found it rather early in life. But for a lot of people, it does seem to be one of those under the radar gems from that great decade of filmmaking. So are you discovering that more people as of late have been discovering it for themselves?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I got a wonderful email, two emails recently from Great Britain, where the film has just been brought out on CD for the first time, and a lot of people who never saw it at that time. Even though it had won the Cannes Festival and therefore had a certain cachet in European theater distribution, it had gone away and it disappeared. And with the release of the CD, they are discovering it. And I've had one critic write me and tell me what a wonderful film he thought it was. And another man and his daughter, a 17-year-old daughter, wrote me to say how the daughter had just flipped over it. Mm. And that is so really gratifying, because there you are touching your audience. And that's what got me started on the whole thing to begin with. And there are still small films. Prince Avalanche, for instance. Somebody just sent me a video of an interview that Gordon Green did of his film, where he mentioned the influence of Scarecrow on Prince Avalanche. So there is a small film.
Wow.
About two guys, and he's mining that territory in his way, and that's wonderful to hear and to learn, and I can't wait to see it.
I've heard that about Prince Avalanche, but I didn't hear him quote Scarecrow directly, so that is so heartening for me to hear that. And his next movie stars Pacino. So they're
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, he has a character drama that he's doing next that Pacino's starring in for him.
Oh, good for him. Well, he's one to watch. There's no question about it. And that is super news. I'm glad to hear that, and good luck to them. Yeah, he did an interview with Paul Rudd and Emil Hirsch, and that's when they mentioned the influence of Scarecrow.
Oh, that's terrific to hear. So tell me about theater today. You have a new play that you've just done. Obviously, you still get a kick out of you're still turned on by theater as strongly as you ever were, it sounds like. But where are we with the dramatic play today?
Well, you have regional theater, which is stronger than it has ever been before in this country. It used to be regional theater is where you do stuff that once upon a time played Broadway. And then, you know, you're doing the 10th rerun of it. Now regional theater is developing new work. And it's a place that Broadway and other New York venues send out their feelers to look at. You know, La Jolla Playhouse is a perfect example. It's a breeding ground for new material. There, St. Louis, Arizona, Texas, Minnesota, there are regional theaters. You know, we in Southern California here, we have South Coast Repertory, which once upon a time did one of my plays. They're developing new material. So you have all kinds of opportunities. And when you get to New York, you then have to be very careful because the rents for any theaters in New York are sky high, which means you have to charge a lot for your tickets, which means you're running the risk of playing, you know, commercial material only. And it's a risk, but it's negotiable. Right now, Broadway is negotiating it by having stars in absolutely everything that they do. That can be okay, and it can be not so okay. But off-Broadway, the Atlantic Theater Company is a splendid example of off-Broadway theater, and it does huge work and often moves their stuff straight to Broadway. Mm-hmm. So I have an agency there called Summit Entertainment, and they're representing my play, which is called The Girl Who Was the Sun, and we're going to be looking for the best venues to move it along.
Mm.
But it's one of those plays that I've worked on for 10 years, and it's fresher than ever in my mind. It's feeling better all the time, and it's very close to being done. I hope to have it finished by the end of October.
Now, we turn to the director of Scarecrow, Mr. Jerry Schatzberg. Mr. Schatzberg began his career in the world of photography, where he captured a series of iconic images, including the album cover to Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde. Prior to Scarecrow, Mr. Schatzberg had directed Faye Dunaway in Puzzle of a Downfall Child, and followed that up with the harrowing Panic in Needle Park, which featured Al Pacino in his first starring role. Scarecrow has always been one of my very favorite films.
Great.
And you've been revisiting it quite a lot this past year because of the 40th anniversary. What has that experience been like for you to revisit?
Well, it's been fantastic. You know, they had a new print made and showed it at Cannes. They had it, and then they showed it at the Lyon Film Festival, which was extraordinary. They had their opening night is in a big arena, and they had 5,000 people, and it was you know, an honor and just a pleasure to see it on such a large screen. But it was interesting because I think about 2-3 months later we had a week of it at the Film Forum in New York, and those it is a quite small and intimate. And I had two different experiences. When I saw it on the big screen, I felt I was going across America with these guys, but I was on the outside watching them. When I saw it in a small theater, I felt I was right with them, you know. It was just a very intimate experience, and it was just terrific.
Were you pleased with the way it played for audiences? I mean, did it feel like a discovery for a lot of those audiences?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they really liked the film. The audiences are fantastic. Also, you know, something that I forget because we all live our lives the same way now with the Internet and with television. And I never had so many people come up to me as in the Lyon Festival saying it was the first time they've ever seen it on the big screen. And that film actually was shot for the big screen. You know, it just has that feeling of space and fantasy in many ways. So these people who had seen it before and liked the film had a new experience also.
Yeah, well, I definitely want to talk to you about the way in which you shot it with Vilmos, but take me back to the beginnings of this. You came on there was an initial director attached to it. That
yeah,
fell out
there was
before
a,
you came
and there was also an initial studio involved with it. It was with at first it was with from what I understand Allied Artists, no, United Artists. And they had planned to do it with Bill Cosby and Jack Lemmon. And I think that would have been, you know, it could have been a very good film, but it would certainly be a different film.
Much different. So they were looking for something more comical, I guess?
Maybe more comical or more commercial or, you know, you can never tell what they're looking for. But that was their thinking of who they should cast it with, that. But then they put it in turnaround, and Warner Brothers picked it up, and they spoke to Pacino and Hackman, and both of them liked the script. Al had read it while we were still, I think, involved in finishing up Panic, and we'd see each other a lot, and he'd tell me about this film that he was going to do, and it sounded great, but I didn't know anything about who was involved with it or what. But then as time went on, evidently both actors just didn't feel comfortable with the director. Mm. And I guess the agents and everybody panicked. And Al, since we had worked together, Al suggested me. Mm. And I received it in the mail one day, and I figured that Al had asked him to send it so that I could, you know, talk to him about it for his own character and his own part. But it turns out that they were sending it to me, didn't to see if I liked it, and I did. I liked it very much.
Well, I read an interview with Pacino where he said it was one of the very best scripts he's ever read. So obviously you had the same reaction.
Yeah, except that, you know, interpretation is something else, too, because you can read a script and then, and I have no idea what went on between them and the first director, but maybe they didn't like his interpretation of what they were reading. And when I got it, my interpretation, I think, was different than the author's interpretation, because when he saw the film, he was very respectful and he liked the film. But he said it was not his film. You know, he had a different view of it. And I think if you give a script to 5 different directors, you're going to get 5 different films.
Well, yeah, that's always the kind of the the give and take there when somebody else picks up your script to interpret it. I mean, that's the nature of
right.
art form. But tell me, when you read it, what you recognized in it, what you saw in it that you wanted.
Well, I just saw the humanity in it. I just liked the love story between two guys who start out grumbling at one another and end up loving one another.
Yeah.
And the experience they go through it, you know, it's they're people on the margin. They're not everyday people, but those people have the same lives as everybody else.
And I think that's something that we're not reminded of enough anymore, like we
exactly.
were back then. You know, and you could make movies about people that live in the margins. Back then, it seems like, from a spectator's perspective. But tell me about the 70s America that you were portraying in that movie.
Well, first of all, it was right after the counterculture revolution, which took place in the 60s, you know, with new music and new ideas and asking questions, where before that, we just, if we were told to do something, we did it. We didn't... object to anything. We just felt, oh, that's the way life is, and we'll go on that way. But I think the 70s were reflecting what we learned in the 60s from the counterculture revolution and what we learned in the 50s from the Beat Generation. And here we had different attitudes. I mean, you can still see the same relations between people, but what changes is their acceptances of one another. I think.
Yeah. Is there, I wanted to ask you, obviously, questions about the performances in the film, because you're working in this film with two of the greatest actors that I think we've ever seen on screen.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Joining for the first and, I think, the only time. So tell me about that relationship, how it grew during the course of filming.
When I met with, because I had to go out and meet Hackman, because I'd never met him before, and he put the okay on it, so I was hired to do it. But then in the first week of rehearsal, he reminded me that he's quite paranoid that Al and I had worked together before. And I said, well, you don't have to worry about that, because that's no consideration for me. I work with all my actors, I love them all, and I'll work, you know, listen to them all, and, you know, not necessarily accommodate, but reason with them in a way that they can understand. And a perfect example, we started the first day of shooting, and when I said action on that first shot, and he was coming down the hill, but where the tree is, he waved his hands and stopped it, because I went up to see what was the matter, and he wanted to know why he was on this hill walking down to this road, you know, and I had to justify it by telling him that on the other side of the hill is a train, and that's the train that he was riding on, and he jumped off. He knew that there was a road on the other side of the hill, so he was up and over, and, you know, you know, he just needed that, and actors do need things. But both of them are different kind of actors. Hackman can put on the costume, and he's the character, and Al puts on the costume, and he stays there through the whole film.
Yeah.
And that's their way of working, and they both produce beautifully in their own method, you know. But I don't think Al realized at first that Hackman might have been annoyed by some of his antics, because sometimes you can't communicate with somebody who's not being a real person and just being a character all the time. So there were those difficulties, and Hackman, I think, used that as part of his character, because he started to intimidate Al, even off camera, and I knew this was happening, and I sort of felt that this was his method, and I let it happen because it worked for the film, hoping that by the time it's over, they'll all be friends and hugs and kisses, and it was pretty much that.
Did you have the luxury of shooting mostly in sequence, or was it all out of order?
Yeah, we started at one part of the country, and then we made stops, and we started in California, I think then we went to Denver and then to Detroit, and that is the continuity of the film. And wherever possible, we would do scenes in continuity. But even if the scenes weren't in continuity, the section of the film was in continuity, and they could feel, you know, it was like doing a play for them. Didn't have to go to the beginning, then down to the end, and back to the middle, and down to the end, and back to the beginning. They were just able to keep their character in the mood that that part of the scene required.
Was there, in terms of performance, was there, because Hackman's character is, he's very abrasive, and Pacino's lion is very kind of sweet and vulnerable. Was it tricky to find the tones of that so it didn't go too far?
No, I don't think so. Characters? I think Hackman is kind of abrasive. Hackman is the first one to admit, even when he's interviewed on television, that he never gets along with any directors he works with. But he convinced me that I was one that he got along with in a very strong way. He said it, but. You know, because he had just finished doing a film in London, and he kept bitching and moaning about the director. And he said, "Come on, Gene, you say you don't get along with any directors you work with." And he said, "I get along with you." I said, "Oh, yeah."
So there's also what's remarkable about the movie to me as well is the tremendous sense of environment. I mean, it really brings these places to life that they're traveling in and out of. And you brought in non-actors or people that lived in those towns to play a role in many of those scenes, didn't you?
That's right. Not to the likes of Hackman all the time, but I'd use that. I went and cast in each of the places we went, and I found people that I thought were quite good. You know, I mean, everybody always thinks that the little boy that's supposed to be Lion's son is his son because he looks so much like Al.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's just my feeling about casting and my feeling about location. You know, understand before that I was a photographer, so I have a feeling for environment and I have a feeling for the character too. I think my the one thing that I was concerned with when I started, and as I worked through my successive films, I became much more confident in was whether I could handle the actors, you know, and speak their language, because they do have a language of their own. But I think the way I work accommodates certainly Gene's way of working. You know, after certain scenes, he would come and thank me for giving him an accent that he could react to. Mm. They love to just be the character and not always know exactly what's going to happen. And I like it that way. I like improvisation. And Hackman's a very funny guy, and I knew this. And before we come to the end of a scene, I wouldn't cut. I'd keep the cameras rolling because they don't cut until I say cut. And I knew Hackman was going to say something. And the scene in the first cafe where he says at the end, "I'll have a bottle of beer and a chocolate donut," and it really cracks Pacino up. And
yeah.
You can't get that kind of laughing unless it's real.
Absolutely.
And so I find things like that can help them and help me get something fresh from them.
What's also terrific and refreshing about the movie, too, is that it's patience. Because you have two just remarkable lead actors that you're working with,
mm-hmm.
So you'll hold them in a single shot and let the scene
right.
play out without interruption.
That same scene in the cafe, I think it's 8 minutes, and they just go through it in 8 minutes. I put one cut in there just for the guy who goes over to the cigarette machine, but otherwise I stay on them in one shot, and I don't move it and let them talk it out.
Yeah, I love that. I wish everything wasn't cut all up every 3 seconds.
Well, I do too, but sometimes it's necessary. You know, if it's possible to shoot that way and it serves the film, you know, you do it that way. But if it needs cuts, because a lot of films need cuts, because it's a film of picture language, you know, and all the cuts and zooms and everything, they mean something to what we're saying. You know, I prefer to find it in the action of the film and the pictures and in words, because it really is motion pictures.
Right. You know, but it's also so it's great looking cinema as well. I mean, it's shot so beautifully for the big
screen.
Well,
you know,
set.
I had a different idea of what I thought it should be when I started, because since they were on the road and they were traveling across country, I thought I'd do a lot of movement, a lot of the camera, and travel across country with them. And then when I mentioned this to Vilmos Zsigmond, he said, "Well, that's funny. I didn't see it that way." I said, "Well, tell me how you saw it." And he said, "Well, I see it as a fairy tale." And that struck a bell with me, and I liked that. And, you know, he was saying certain things that, because, you know, I don't care who comes up with a good idea when, because we're working with at least 100 people, and they all are supposed to be professionals and contributors, you know, and if they come up with the idea, that's great. And so that's the way we went. We wanted it to be more of a fairy tale.
Well, it's such a special portrait of the America at that time. And I find it very interesting that, you know, I know Vilmos, his struggles coming up as a cameraman and how he got into the country and started working. But his had to have been a very unique perspective on the American experience, I think.
Well, you know, we traveled across the country a couple of times together before we ever started shooting, and it's quite beautiful. I think everybody should do that at least once because the perspective is so different everywhere you travel. You know, you can see a storm that's in full force 100 miles away in some areas because the land is so flat. And you just see things that. If you stay in the city all the time, you know, you see a lot of buildings, and you know, I love New York, but sometimes the country feeds you differently. And also, if you see foreigners that come to America to shoot films, even in New York, they come with a different perspective, and you learn things from their view, from what they see. You see it every day, so it's not so special. But when they come and they see it, it becomes special.
Yeah. Tell me about the cut of the movie that we all know and love. Was anything sacrificed in that final cut that was painful?
Well, it was painful, but also necessary. There were two cuts, two scenes that I took out. One I didn't like at all. It was a scene that I had Al do an improvisation when he's in prison and he gets to be director of the. Of the theater group, and so he does an improv, but it didn't work at all. I mean, there were pieces of it, but it just didn't fit this film. And the other thing is a great scene with Hackman and Pacino when they get out of prison. We stop at a bar, and they have to go to the toilet, and there's a scene in the toilet. It's just really funny between these two guys, and Emily says things about them. But it was a point in the film where I just didn't, you know, it was not necessary to show another scene. It was necessary to keep on traveling because they're going to Detroit. You know, they're going to settle their business and start a car wash in Denver. So we didn't need any more build-up to the story.
And tell me about foreign audiences and how they responded to it, because you picked up the Palme d'Or that year.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm very popular with the foreign audiences. I wish the Americans would catch on as fast, but the Americans are catching on now. They see a vision of New York. They don't get to see, or of America. They don't get to see all the time. They see two great actors performing. There's a lot of humor in the film. There's a lot of pathos in the film. You know, I always say I love to cry in my films, and I always do. You know, and I find that moment that really touches me. I've also, I don't know if you read it because I mentioned it a lot, but I've written a sequel to this, but I just don't think it'll ever get on. Because, one, Hackman is retired, and once he makes up his mind to do something, that's it. And I've sent it to Al. If Al is interested, and I never know because, you know, when you've got 16 people managing you, they all say, no, you can't do that because there's no money in it. You can't do that because it's this. And, you know, they all want to do Spider-Man and Iron Man.
Right.
But that I think that's coming to an end also.
But I was interested in what you wanted to continue to explore in those characters.
You mean for the sequel?
Yes, sir.
Oh, lots. First of all, it takes place 30 years later, so what happened to them? Well, in my mind, since he was determined and he had the money, they started a car wash. It's a very successful car wash. Lion character, he recovers in the hospital, and then he decides that, you know, he's got to make something of himself in life, and he's just out of the Navy, so he goes back to school on the GI Bill, and he becomes very astute at computers and working. And he's the smart one of the two, although he lets the other one think that he's the smart one, and he's running everything. Max marries Frenchie, and they adopt a Chinese baby, and she's now in her early 20s, and she swears as much as he swears. You know, she's a real tough cookie and had a lot of fun. And then we bring into the story the son that Lion thinks is dead, who is not, but is in living in Detroit and getting into a lot of trouble.
I pray that happens, that movie happens.
I do too.
Yeah,
but it's not something that Warner Brothers would want to do, and I don't know whether they own the rights so that they could stop it from being used. But if they do, that would be a shame. But if not, I have to figure out what to do with it, with the Hackman part. You know, I could probably find a very good actor that could do it, because it's 30 years later, and you don't always remember what people look like.
Of course.
But
yeah.
But I have a few other choices, so you know, I keep that in the back of my mind. Right now, I'd like to see what Al thinks of it.
That's it for this special episode of Movie Geeks United. We'll keep you posted on the status of both the Scarecrow stage play and the possible sequel to the film as well. Thanks for listening.